Hello and welcome to another instalment of History Hack. We got something really exciting today. Alina, tell everyone about it.
We've got with us Sergio Canastone, who is an archaeologist working at the Institute of Heritage Sciences of the Spanish National Research Council, and she was a teaching fellow at UCL Institute of Archaeology. And today we're going completely out of the box and we're going to be talking about the Mali Empire. Welcome, Sergio.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me.
This is really good. We don't do nearly enough African history, so this is going to be really interesting for our listeners as well. What got you interested in African history, and where do you find your sources?
So I guess that what got me into it is the fact that I knew absolutely nothing about it. Like, I think it was must have been my second year undergrad. I saw there was an option on African states, and then I just suddenly realized that all I knew about Africa was human origins and colonialism. And I knew absolutely nothing between those two things. So I took this option and I was just like fascinated because there's, of course, there's things that happen between those two elements. There's like all kinds of states and civilizations and just other human groups that are interesting for all kinds of reasons. And not only that, but also it challenges many of the things that we take for granted about how human societies work and how human societies evolve, from like technical stuff like being able to have iron before bronze, which doesn't really happen in Europe and the Middle East, to how states are structured. So suddenly all these theoretical models that are generally based on ideas from and examples from the Middle East and Europe don't work in Africa at all, which makes us forces us to rethink what we know about the diversity of the human past, which I really like.
That's really good. It's like you say, this is a classic case, isn't it, of a historian wanting to know more about something, finding nobody else has done it, so spending their whole life working on it.
Yes. I mean, it's a whole continent. There's quite a few of us doing it now, but it's still really interesting. And what you mentioned about the sources is another one of the things that it's really, really interesting. Because I can't really speak for the whole continent because it's massive, but for the bit I know more about in West Africa, that's something that also hooked me in, the diversity of the sources. Because you have oral traditions, which are really, really rich and absolutely fascinating. Most of the societies there don't really have a tradition of written history, with some notable exceptions, but they have super strong methods of keeping history alive by passing it orally. So in the former area of the Mali Empire, you have the griots, which are specialists of the spoken word that can talk about history from the 13th century onwards. And of course, this is political history, because the reason why these people exist is to sing praises of important people by reminding them of how great their ancestors are. But I mean, that all history is political in some way or others. And there's so many lineages and so many different traditions, from like massive epics to small village stories, that you can check one with the other and create this incredibly rich tapestry. But on top of that, it has some written indigenous sources, like the Timbuktu Tariqs, for instance, from the 17th and 19th centuries. You have all the texts from Arabic traders and geographers and historians starting on the 8th century, really. And then you get all the Europeans coming on the coast and also writing their own things, plus the archaeology, which is extremely exciting because there's been a lot less done than in other parts of the world. So every single excavation changes what we know about the history of a particular region in ways that sometimes is quite dramatic. And being able to put all these sources together in this wonderful multi-layered puzzle is something that I absolutely adore as well.
So first of all, because we're going to talk about the Mali Empire, can you tell us where Mali is actually located?
Okay, so basic coordinates, Somali. Mali was an empire that started in the 13th century, starts dispersing into its component parts in the 16th, so 13th to 16th century. And it was it was massive. So it covered the areas where currently we have the states of Mali, Senegal, the Gambia, Guinea-Bissau, Burkina Faso, and also parts of Mauritania, Ivory Coast, and Sierra Leone. So quite big.
How did they form an empire? Because that is big. So mm-hmm. How was it created? How did that come about?
So initially, before being a massive empire, Mali was a relatively small kingdom in the southern half of what's currently Mali. We know it already existed by the 11th century because Arab historians mention it. And in the 13th century was quite a bit lot of turmoil because the power that had formerly controlled the area, the Ghana Empire, had less power. And then there was a range of smaller states fighting for control. And eventually boiled down to two states, Sosso and Mali. And it was Mali that won, and that the leadership of the legendary Sinjata Keita, who defeated everybody and started expanding in all directions. And this Sinjata, it's a bit of a King Arthur figure, in that we know he probably did exist, but there's also all kinds of mythical stuff attached to him. And the main source for the beginning of the empire, we don't really know much other than like the general outline. The main source is his epic called the Sinjata epic, named after Sinjata, obviously. And that it's the most awesome adventure story that has everything in it. It has from like a mother with supernatural powers that can turn into a porcupine, brotherly treason, the hero that has to go into exile, having to flee after being the son of the king, but starting from zero in foreign lands, epic battles against a sorcerer king called Sumanguru, all kinds of stuff. The day Hollywood gets its hands on it, it's going to be an absolutely amazing film. but it also has some like generally historically useful bits, which we just to piece together what we know about the early empire. But effectively is that it's a small kingdom, finds a vacuum of power, starts conquering other people and forging alliances, because we call it an empire, but really in some ways it's more a federation with an unequal relationship between the different parts. So some parts were directly controlled centrally, others were more autonomous and just paid taxes once a year. So the relationship of the core of the empire to the rest was quite diverse.
Well, were they king, emperors? How do we reference these people? But were there any unusual ones?
Oh yes, certainly. Well, Sinjata, for starters, was quite an interesting one because, according to the very rich Sinjata epic, has all kinds of magical powers and thus all the supernatural stuff. But there were others that were very interesting. We have some that come to mind, I guess. Sakura, who was a some Japanese but isn't Ismailian, 14th century emperor that started his life as a slave. Was freed and eventually managed to become the emperor himself. We don't really know much about him because it's just an Arab historian, Ibn Khaldun, that talks about him. We know he was a devout Muslim and he, in fact, was killed on his return from Mecca. But yes, slaves did actually have more power than you'd think in the Mali Empire. The head of the slaves was a very, very powerful figure in court. And yeah, we had a former slave becoming emperor. Another famous one is Mansa. So Mansa is the title that kings received. So we have Mansa Sakura, and it was Mansa Muhammad in the 14th century that, according to his successor, he really wanted to discover what was at the end of the Atlantic Ocean. So he filled 200 ships with men and 200 with gold and provisions for years, and he told them, do not come back till you find land or your provisions run out. And of those boats, only one came back and said, well, all the others died. So the empress is like, not good enough. So he went himself with 1,000 boats and was never heard from again. So some people have argued this is the Malians arriving to America before Columbus, but probably wasn't the case. Probably it was a much sadder end. But he was quite an eccentric one. The most famous one, though, by far, is Mansa Musa, who was a 14th century also emperor that became famous because he converted Islam and he decided to do the pilgrimage to Mecca. And on his way, he stopped in Cairo and he brought so much gold with him that he devalued the price of gold for over 2 decades.
That is a lot of bling.
I mean, somebody recently calculated that he was the richest person to ever have lived. Adjusting for inflation and so on. So quite a remarkable character, that one.
That's amazing. Mali has a profile beyond its own borders, though, doesn't it? What is Mali known for in the medieval period around the world?
So So especially after this trip to Cairo, and it's important to say that this Mansa Musa, he wasn't the richest or the most important king of Mali. He just the one that showed up the day everybody had brought the cameras, i.e. he showed up at the height of Mamluk historiography, so everybody wrote about him. And then all these stories of the Malian king covered in gold spread across the Arab world in Europe. So there's the main thing that's associated across the medieval period with Mali, tons of gold. And Mansa Musa quite literally puts Mali on the map because there's a 14th century atlas from a geographer in Mallorca, in the Balearic Islands, well, that has the first known depiction, European depiction of the king of Mali. And it's this really rich, regal man with a massive golden nugget in his hand. So throughout this period, Mali is directly associated with gold. Something that I'd like to say, though, that's often, like, people don't realize this, but during this whole period, European kingdoms and African kingdoms traded as equals. Mm. Because afterwards, there's this, with imperialism and colonialism, there's this diminishing of the importance, like, of the way African kingdoms are portrayed. But in these initial portrayals, there's, like, our brother king of Mali sells us this stuff. And African kingdoms send diplomatic embassies to Spain, to France, to the Vatican, all for the period as equals. So the way, summing up, I guess, the way the Mali Empire is known in this period is like super powerful, really loaded, and another of the great kingdoms of the era.
So where was the capital of Mali?
Okay, that's a more difficult question than it sounds. Because so we have this like incredibly wealthy empire, enormous geographically, that we know from oral traditions and Arabic sources. So obviously archaeologists, the first thing that we want to find is the massive capital. There's even an account of an Arab traveler called Ibn Battuta that visited the capital of Mali in 1352 and described this awesome town where the emperor had got himself an Andalusian interior designer / poet to make this reception hall for him that looked awesome and has golden arches. So for decades, archaeologists try to find this famous capital of this powerful empire to no use. Really, we haven't found it yet. If you look on like Wikipedia and even Encyclopedia Britannica, it says that the capital is in a place called Niani. This is incorrect. The reason for this is because the first printed version of the Sunjata epic said that the capital was Niani in current Guinea. But there were excavations there in the 70s, and the excavations show there's a massive occupation gap between the 13th and the 16th centuries. It was exactly when the empire existed. So this could not have been the capital visited by the Arab travelers. So where was it? There's different options, and it's a very long debate. I was part of a team that excavated site in the north called Sorotomo, which has the right dates, and it's big enough, and it's a very promising candidate. But what some people, including myself, have been arguing is that we got this whole thing wrong, that looking for the capital is going about it in the wrong way, because if you look at oral traditions, nobody talks about capitals. They talk about Mansa Dugus. That means literally king's town. And why is this important? Because a king's town doesn't have to always be in the same place, and a king may have multiple towns. And what we get from the impression you get from oral traditions is that kings just change the center of power from king to king and even from period to period. That this idea that the capital always has to be in the same place and that kings inherit that space from one another is not really relevant to this context. That what we should be looking for are far more transient sites, that political centers are quite mobile and depend on the king. And it was even possible that kings had multiple king's towns at the same time. And that by looking at the capital, we've been looking for the wrong concept. And the largest sites were commercial cities, Timbuktu, Gao, Djenne, Dja, all of these sites have been excavated because they were so big and people assumed they must have been the capital, were actually trading towns and political centers were a lot more ephemeral. So there's also then challenges of understanding of what a big empire is supposed to work like.
Nobody wants to hear that version though, because Nicolas Cage can't make a treasure hunting film out of that.
Oh, sure he can. I mean, that's a film to look for. Not that that's what anybody wants to find, because that's just going to be problems.
Yeah, it's interesting though that that's sort of a modern thing that we're projecting backwards, looking for this one centre where everything worked from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very much a modern notion. It's not even a European or Middle Eastern one, because we have plenty of examples of medieval Europe of power centres that shifted, courts that shifted. Ethiopia had roving capitals at the time. So we just need to readjust our notions to the fact that things in the past worked differently, and that's a good and interesting thing.
So we now know that there's no massive Mali Empire now. So what happened to it?
Well, the Mali Empire starts gradually losing power. In the 15th century, it starts losing all its vassal states in the north. In the 16th century, the Atlantic province, Cabo, becomes independent because it's getting quite wealthy in the Atlantic trade. Then there's the Songhai Empire in the northeast that gradually conquers all of Mali's territories in the 16th century. It also loses control of the gold mines. And it probably, Mali as a much smaller kingdom survives, well, definitely survived into the 17th century, even longer. But it just, its component parts start getting more powerful. It has the Songhai Empire in the north, all kinds of other powers attacking it, and it just disperses into its component parts. But I think it's worth mentioning that its legacy, it's one of the strongest historically in all of Africa, because not only was the current country named after it when it all got its independence in the 1960s, the first elected president of Mali was Modibo Keita, whose surname is of the same lineage as Njaza Keita, the founder of the empire. So obviously, there's still the history of Mali carries an enormous weight culturally and politically across the whole region.
Right. So we want to do a bit of myth busting. I'm actually really interested to how you respond to people when they say to you that the people who really built Africa are aliens.
Oh, that's what every serious historian wants to hear.
But I'm underlining that I do not believe in this at all.
But that's a classic one. And when I was at UCL, I would regularly get people calling into the office asking me about aliens. There's a friend of mine, Gabe Moshenska, wrote a very, very cool paper about alternative fringe archaeologists. And what he showed is that as soon as you scratch his hand a bit, aliens tend to be like racism, anti-Semitism, and white supremacism, really not very well disguised. I saw this t-shirt the other day on the internet, which I proceeded to buy immediately, that said, just because white people didn't build it doesn't mean it was aliens.
That's brilliant.
That's what it tends to be. So Great Zimbabwe is one of the most famous archaeological sites in all of Africa. It's really, really impressive ruins. And when Europeans first discovered it, they said, obviously, Africans couldn't have built this. It must have been the Phoenicians. It must have been the Queen of Sheba. It must have been all kinds of people. And obviously, I must say, not all Europeans. They were like, there was a lovely archaeologist called Gertrude Clayton Thompson that actually said, that's not true. It was Africans. It was definitely Africans. But aliens are the new Queen of Sheba. Aliens are the new Phoenicians. It just, all racism used to attribute this to other people, or new racism just attributes it to aliens. But that's all it is. So I just had to explain this time and time again. Because some people just say this with like the best of intentions and then realize all the like really horrible stuff that lies just a tiny bit below the surface of these alien stories. But at the end of the day, it's just racism disguised.
Exactly, like, because Alex and I have come across this a couple of times, is that aliens built the pyramids.
Mm-hmm. With the same thing. Obviously, white people were not involved, therefore it must have been aliens. There's all kinds of perfectly, we know how these things were built. And to be fair, if you have that amount of manpower and time, it's not that difficult to understand how it was built.
I think we all know that the pyramid is actually an inflatable, because this was revealed in the Minions movie. Despicable Me. Giant inflatable. It wasn't aliens.
That makes so much more sense.
Yeah, absolutely. So racism is one, and I guess I want to ask you what problems you face with popular conceptions and stuff. I'm guessing you spend your whole life beating your head against a wall because everyone's preconceptions about all of African history are shaped by colonialism later on.
Ish. Like, I understand, because that's where I was when I started. Like, what got me to this was my own ignorance about this fascinating history. So I understand, and I'm trying to fix it. But the problem, I guess, is there's a lot of interest in African history, but because until recently there were not archaeologists relatively young in the continent, and now there's some countries like Senegal. I'm like lucky enough to work in a country where there's a really good archaeology department that has a very, very productive PhD program. So there's all kinds of amazing Senegalese archaeologists. But other African countries don't have archaeology departments, and therefore there's not that much archaeology being carried on in the country. And the few archaeologists that exist are too busy dealing with primary research as to write general public stuff. And I was doing exactly the same. And one day, like, I can't believe all this public stuff about Africa is so bad. Why are people not writing better things? And then I realized, well, if people like me were not doing it, who was going to do it? Because we were the ones with the information. So I took it on as part of my work to try to generate more accessible resources about African history. So I did a couple of like talks and publications and so on to try to make this more accessible, because I think there's the lingering habits of colonialism and imperialism that had to deny the existence of African history in order to justify the supposedly civilizing missions. Because if somebody has already extremely rich civilizations, you cannot really justify civilizing them. So they had to deny the existence of African history in order to supposedly justify what they were doing, which wasn't that at all. So we're still dealing with that legacy. Plus, the objectively small amount of archaeology has been done, that's a really difficult mix that we need to overcome. But I think I see more and more colleagues taking the time to produce accessible materials for the general public. So I'm really hoping this will change in coming years. And it's really important it does, because otherwise we're just, again, feeling racism and these misconceptions of Africa as an eternal present of hunter-gatherers and hunger and huts and drought. And there's definitely hunter-gatherers and huts, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that, but that's not all African history is. It's far richer than that.
I'm tempted to go onto Wikipedia and start naming things out for you in a list. I think we might be here all day, though.
Yes, probably.
What, before we round off, who was your favourite character or person within the Mali Empire that you've come across?
Oh, it wasn't actually, well, so my own work is not on the central Mali Empire. I work on the Atlantic province that was called Kabu. And something cool about Kabu is that it had queens. The Mali Empire mostly had male rulers, but Kabu just every now and then had female rulers. And these female rulers were also warriors, and they were absolutely amazing. And there was one, a 19th century one, called Fanta Sanye, that managed to, she was this amazing diplomat, and she managed to, at a time where power was fading, because Kabul had just collapsed, and you had the French trying to arrive, the Portuguese trying to arrive, the Brits, multiple warlords in the region, everybody fighting for power. She managed to side with the French to defeat the British, and then side with the British to defeat the French, and then side with both of them to defeat her cousin. And stay in
power. Brilliant. Time.
And she was amazing. So I think she probably would be one of my favourites.
What was her name?
Fanta Sanye.
That's amazing. You have, so obviously you have the stuff on the rulers and that. Do you find stuff about everyday people?
Not people like named as such. Well, some individuals are often difficult to trace archaeologically, obviously. We have burials, and for instance, in northern Mali, with as Islam becomes more widespread, we start having tombstones that sometimes give us names of specific people that were there, who were nothing, they were not emperors, they were not kings or any important people, they were just ordinary people. We can get a bit of information from those burials. But other than that, we just get traces. So if we excavate a furnace, we get some idea of what the life of that blacksmith was like. If we excavate a kiln, we can get an idea of what those potters were doing. But it's mostly like hints and suggestions rather than details, histories of specific individuals.
So coming back to your research, because I know you're going out to do some excavating really soon, aren't you?
Yeah, just in a few days. Next Monday, I'm heading to Senegal, which should be fun.
You're allowed to leave the house. That's amazing. So what's going on there?
So we're looking at, luckily, the COVID situation it's much better in Senegal. We're still taking all kinds of precautions, all the teams getting tests, we'll keep distances and so on. And we won't be excavating, we'll just be surveying and collecting old traditions. But what we're going to be documenting the fortresses of our particular area of Kabou. So I mentioned Kabou was the Atlantic province of Mali, and Kabou itself was divided into smaller territories. So we're going to be looking at one specific territory called Pachana that survived as a political unit through five different states. And we're going to be looking at its fortresses and how they change over time. So that should be fun. I'm taking all the toys, including drones and stuff, to get nice maps, which I'm quite excited about.
Oh, my drone's been in its backpack for so long now. He needs to fly again. Poor little Stanley. Oh, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for coming and giving us an overview of the Mali Empire and sort of putting that gap, that big gap you mentioned between birth of man and colonialism, giving us something to put in there. It's a great start for us.
Yeah, there's a lot more. And hopefully you've got other colleagues to start filling it as well.
Absolutely. Send them all our way.
I shall. Thank you so much for having me.
Join us tomorrow when Louise Creechan will be with us to talk all about Victorian learning difficulties. We're going to be talking about the likes of autism and dyslexia and dyspraxia and how they were dealt with at the time. So don't miss that.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/hackhistory, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.
Don't forget that we do exist on Patreon as History Hack and on Patreon as well, which is Podbean's own version. Alina and I have had massive fun doing this in 2020, but life's going to change quite a lot next year, and we're going to actually have to go and earn a living, etc. If we want to keep up the regularity that we've been bringing you and the kind of guests that we've been bringing you and the workload, then we will need your help. So if you join, there's going to be incentives for joining on either of those platforms. We're revamping ourselves on both of them. So don't forget to go in. You can do as little as $1 a month, and it all goes towards keeping up History Hack as regular as we've been able to bring it to you this year. We are now on YouTube. We are posting all of our new episodes on there, and we have our own channel, and we are gradually posting all of the back episodes because we have been made aware of the fact that you can only find the last 100 on some platforms. So you can go and listen to your heart's content and laugh at the cartoons and have a great time. So do go over there and subscribe.